Welcome to KPFK, established in 1959 on the Pacifica Radio Network, a broadcast service of, by, and for the people. 90.7 FM Los Angeles, 98.7 Santa Barbara, 93.7 San Diego, and 99.5 Ridgecrest, China Lake. People Power is on your radio.
This is Feminist Magazine, a weekly radical radio show and podcast produced by a diverse collective of feminists. And every week we bring you a mix of intersectional stories and guests to help you resist and engage. Because we want you to know a little bit more about Feminist Magazine, who we are and how we do it, and why you'll want to support feminist radio on the air on KPFK every week. And I'm Lynn Harris-Ballin, your host today, and this is what feminism can sound like.
I'm Amy Castello. Today, we're revisiting a story we first published in 2023. It's about criminalized survival, or how survivors of intimate partner violence become entangled in and punished by the criminal justice system.
And I was like, wait, like, we're putting women and survivors in prison for fighting for their own lives.
That's journalist and survivor Natalie Patillo. Together, she and cinematographer Daniel Nelson made the award-winning documentary film And So I Stayed. We interviewed them last year, and today we're sitting down with Natalie again. There is a lot to catch up on. A lot of it is good. Stay with us. I'm Amy Gastelum. You're listening to Making Contact. Today's show is a powerful story of solidarity and response to the problem of intimate partner violence. Please take care when you're listening today. Now to our interview with reporter Natalie Patillo. Hey, girl, hey.
Hey.
So, Natalie, just to recap for our listeners, your film, And So I Stayed, follows three women's stories: Tanisha Davis, Nikki Adamando, and Kim Dadu Brown. All were sentenced to many years in prison after actions they took to protect themselves from their abusers, which resulted in their deaths. The film follows these women, but it also follows the fight to get a law passed in New York that would give hope to people like Kim, Nikki, and Tanisha, who have been incarcerated after surviving domestic violence. It's called the Domestic Violence Survivors Justice Act, or DVSJA. Can you summarize what the DVSJA does?
The DVSJA allows judges to look at domestic violence as a significant contributing factor to a crime. So it works in two ways. Folks can be sentenced under the law, which means less harsh sentencing. And then it can also be used for folks who are currently incarcerated and the crime predated this law's existence. So then they're able to potentially get out earlier than their original sentencing.
So Natalie, in your film, we learned that Tanisha was able to use this law on appeal to get her sentence reduced, that retroactive sentencing we were talking about. And so the third woman in the film, Nikki Adamando, was tried and sentenced after the DVSJA passed. But here's the thing, the judge in her case didn't really seem to consider the new law. The judge sentenced her to 19 years to life in prison, which is like not a reduction at all. And so in the end of your film, is really heartbreaking because Nikki is still at Bedford Hills and her sister Michelle is raising Nikki's kids and fighting to get her sister's sentence reduced. But a lot has happened since then, right? For one thing, Nikki is out.
Nikki is out. The case thankfully went to the appellate court, and the appellate court did think she was eligible. So they were able to use the law in Nikki Adamando's case and say, actually, she does qualify. She is eligible for the DVSJA, and she did get a sentence reduction.
Right. So now that Nikki's out, she has been advocating for laws similar to the DVSJA. Here's some audio from an Instagram post that she made with her sister, Michelle Horton, in March. They are cozied up on the sofa in their living room.
As you know, the only reason I'm home right now is because of the DVSJA. So a law passing like this in Oklahoma would have the potential to help hundreds of incarcerated survivors.
And the survivors in Oklahoma really need this. We were told that Oklahoma has the highest rate of domestic violence in the country and also the highest number of incarcerated women. Obviously, those two things go hand in hand. So what we need to do right now is to encourage Oklahoma senators to say yes to Senate Bill 1470.
Okay, so update here to this Oklahoma law. Girl, it passed. So how did it feel to watch this law pass in Oklahoma?
I mean, honestly, of all states, like, to be frank, it just doesn't come to mind as like Oklahoma will be next. But the organizers in Oklahoma have worked very hard.
So yeah, so I talked to Alexandra Bailey to get some more information about this. She is a senior campaign strategist with the Sentencing Project. They advocate for effective and humane responses to crime that minimize imprisonment and criminalization of youth and adults by promoting racial, ethnic, economic, and gender justice. Okay, so Ms. Bailey, who is also a survivor of domestic violence, has been working hard on this Oklahoma bill. And she said what really motivated her to pursue this law was a Mother Jones article she read about a case in Oklahoma highlighting failure to protect laws, which is one of the ways that survivors get entangled by the criminal justice system, right? Can you explain failure to protect laws?
Right. So a survivor could be with a partner who is abusive. That abusive partner could cause harm to a child. And just because the survivor might not be able to leave or was just present whenever the abuse took place, those failure to protect laws can cause these survivors to be criminalized. Mm-hmm. It doesn't make sense, and it'll never make sense to me.
Well, you're not the only one. Here's Alexandra Bailey talking about the Mother Jones article that she read.
And it highlights one particular case about a woman who was in a terrible domestic violence situation that could have taken her life. And her children attempted to intervene. And one of them got pushed out of the way and hurt themselves. And she went to prison for that. And the even more ironic part is that, or terrible part, I guess I should say, is that her children were given to her ex-partner, who had already spent multiple years in prison for committing domestic violence against her. So just
it's baffling.
Utterly
it doesn't
ridiculous.
Make any
yeah,
sense.
Just you can't, it's like you eat too much ice cream and your brain no longer functions.
So this was 2022, and in this Mother Jones article, Alexandra saw Colleen McCarty's name. She's the executive director of the Oklahoma Appleseed Center for Law and Justice. They connected, Alex secured funding, and together they created a coalition to write a law that used New York's DVSJA as a template. The coalition included representatives from tribal nations because Oklahoma is Indian country. That means that there's various legal conditions to consider. And it is worth noting that Indigenous American women are the group that experiences the most intimate partner homicide in the United States.
And the great thing is that we've been in lockstep with incarcerated women from the beginning.
Word. So they had a few false starts in the legislature, but in the end, Alex told me that this bill
flies through the state legislature. I mean, just flies. It goes through committee, unanimous vote. It goes through the other committee, unanimous vote. It gets to the floor of the Senate, unanimous vote. It transfers to the floor of the House, three no votes. Unheard of in Oklahoma.
Were you surprised?
At those numbers, at unanimous in Oklahoma?
Right.
I don't think you could get a unanimous vote on saving the dolphins.
My mom's people are from Oklahoma, so like...
Yeah.
I noticed that part of the new law, just like New York's DVSJA, says that there has to be a high burden of proof. Mm-hmm. And this has been an issue for survivors. So the latest National Domestic Violence Hotline survey showed that of survey respondents who called the police for help with a domestic violence incident, almost 40% actually felt less safe after calling the police, and that 12% of respondents never even called the police in the first place because they're afraid the police will take their kids or end up arresting them or deport them or make a violent situation worse. This fear of police is disproportionate for Black and Brown women and immigrant women. So requiring evidence, including police reports, to use this law.
It doesn't have to be a police report.
Yeah.
It doesn't have to be a police report.
Okay. What else is included in that burden of proof?
Hospital reports, first person witnesses of abuse can be used. So there are, like, you know, if you had a therapist or you did an outcry to somebody, you know, that is, you know, all things that can be used. We just filed April Wilkins' case in Oklahoma. It's a 425-page document of just witness after witness and testimony after testimony and doctors and, you know, police reports and rape kits and restraining orders. So it seems like everybody knows about it. It was crazy.
And yet, I just want to point out that even though April Wilkins is a white woman with mountains of evidence, like, I'm still on pins and needles to see, is this law going to do what they say it's going to do? Because if you look at Nikki Adamando's case, too, in New York, like, it all came down to that judge the first time that she tried to use it and she still got sentenced to years in prison.
Yeah.
And that's in New York. And I'm like, okay, Oklahoma, like, let's see. Like, I don't know.
Well, yeah, am I on pins and needles? Mm-hmm. Of course. But what I will say is that from the very beginning, we've been willing to go to the mat on this issue. If I have to come back and change the law again and get another avenue, I will. But, you know, it's one of those things where I think what they're starting to understand is we're never going to go away.
Mm.
And there are a lot of women in your state and they vote.
Yeah.
And they don't want their daughters to die.
Right.
And they don't want to die themselves. And they don't want to spend the rest of their lives in prison.
All right. So, Natalie, Alex said that they are starting with 13 cases. April Wilkins is the first. You've heard of April Wilkins, right?
Yes. Yes. I have heard about her case. Definitely.
She's got a lot of media attention, so I'm not surprised that you've heard about it. After April, 9 more cases will be released at the end of September. So that's what's happening next for Oklahoma. Meanwhile, Alex is headed to Louisiana to work on a similar bill there. And she said if anybody listening wants to work on a bill in their state, she is here to help.
We do have a model DVSJA bill with recommendations. And, you want to go down this rabbit hole, I will jump in the hole behind you.
Okay. So, Natalie, we've been keeping an eye on Oklahoma and this bill, and you even gave a showing of your film, And So I Stayed, at Tulsa Community College not long ago. How did that go?
The showing at Tulsa Community College was wonderful.
So one fan of your film wasn't able to make it to your showing, but she had already seen it because she rented it on Vimeo, and that is Amanda Ross, April Wilkins' niece. Amanda has been advocating for her aunt for about 10 years. She was only 7 when her aunt was sentenced to life in prison after she shot her longtime abuser, Terry Carlton, soon after he had handcuffed, beaten, and raped her. And I asked Amanda how she got to know her aunt, April, given the fact that she was in prison when Amanda was a child. Here's Amanda.
She would call my mom every Sunday, and I was eavesdropping the whole time, but it was every Sunday that was like the day we knew to expect a call from her after church.
Okay, so Amanda said that besides these weekly phone calls, she and her aunt sent letters and eventually emails back and forth. She said April was really caring and just a really sweet person. And she never mentioned her case and always asked about Amanda's life. Growing up, Amanda's family supported April. But the message that Amanda got about what happened was kind of confusing.
Even the narrative that my parents would tell me, like even as a little kid, was she wasn't treated fairly by the system, but there was still this undertone that my parents believed she still did something wrong or wasn't as right about things as she could have been. And I think that that comes from living in the Bible Belt and just judging women. And that's not something that I stand for. And that's also something like I've had a lot to unlearn. I'm 34 now and I'm still unlearning.
Back in 2014, April asked Amanda if she could make some copies for her. She was planning to try to get her life sentence reduced, but she needed some clerical help. And Amanda had access to a copy machine, so she made the copies. And on those papers that Amanda copied, she saw April's own account of the abuse she had suffered over the course of several years with Terry Carlton. Amanda had never heard the full story up to that point, so it was shocking and heartbreaking for her. She said around the same time, a producer named Dave Randag made a YouTube video of a recording April had taken of a conversation between herself and Terry. And in it, Terry admits that he beat her, that he raped her.
Hearing him admit it on tape, that was a turning point for me. And so as I was starting to question, you know, how bad was it? That came up. It's kind of funny because when you're in it, like when it's your family, you don't think to even Google things.
Because you think you have the story.
Yeah. Yeah. And I didn't hear that until my 20s. And I don't think my mom and dad had heard it either until recently. But it wasn't played at her trial either. I don't think the jury got a full picture. I know the jury didn't get a full picture.
Amanda said that all of that paperwork, that copying her aunt's story, it did not do anything. April's sentence was not reduced. That was 2022.
So yeah, that was very disappointing. But right around that same time is when Colleen and Leslie entered the picture too. So it really took off. It was like a domino effect after that.
Colleen and Leslie are lawyers with the Oklahoma Appleseed Center for Law and Justice, a leading force in the coalition that Alex Bailey mentioned.
And they didn't make any promises. They were very clear, like, we don't know if we can help your aunt. And she said, if we can't get April out, we can maybe help other people.
Given everything you're saying about all the unfairness that you witnessed firsthand from the state of Oklahoma, were you surprised at how kind of efficiently the Oklahoma Survivors Act, like, went through the process?
I didn't expect it, for sure. It's very weird, but looking back, Oklahoma is weird. We
stop there.
Yeah, like we don't fit normal stereotypes sometimes. How we have tribal governments that have to interact with Oklahoma, and Oklahoma also is very into those stand your ground laws, you know, and self-defense, but it didn't seem to work in April's case. So why doesn't it seem to work for women? But I think that this just speaks also to the fact that there's a domestic violence problem in Oklahoma that affects everyone across party lines. And at this point, I'm wondering who doesn't know someone who is incarcerated at this point because of our high incarceration rate.
You can support KPFK and our show today, Feminist Magazine. Just go to the kpfk.org website and click the donate button. It's easy. If you do that right now, your conscience is clear. You have done it for this fund drive, and then you can go back to listening to the rest of the show. And that is just one example of the kind of story we love to highlight. Feminist Magazine brings you voices like that, and also feminist artists and creatives, plus, of course, local activists telling you ways that you can take action, you know, grassroots action, and make a difference yourself. That is what we actually mean when we say at the top of our show every week that we're bringing you a mix of intersectional stories and guests to help you resist and engage. And you can support us to keep us doing that right now. You can just go to the kpfk.org website and click the donate button. You can give $10, $25, $50, $100, or become a sustaining member. We want to be a sustainable radio station. And so if you just give us your credit card, we do a monthly payment. You choose how much. And then it's a sustainable way to keep bringing you these stories. The site is kpfk.org, and there's a donate button.
If you've tuned into KPFK at all during these last few weeks, you've likely heard your favorite hosts asking you to make a financial contribution in support of this listener-sponsored community radio station. If you have made your contribution, we want to say thank you so much. If you're able to pledge but still have not yet, we really urge you to do so now. The amount of that contribution is, of course, up to you. A single $25 pledge will make you a member, and an ongoing monthly pledge will make you a sustaining member, which is very helpful for KPFK. Only you know what's right for you. As you decide, please consider how consistently KPFK focuses on the issues that matter, and how much the world needs to continue hearing the important voices that regularly broadcast over the KPFK airwaves. Then please give as generously as you're able. You can make your pledge on our website at kpfk.org/donate, or you can call 818-985-5735. That's 818-985-KPFK. Thank you for listening, and thank you for contributing.
You're listening to Feminist Magazine on KPFK, 90.7 FM, and kpfk.org.
Journalist and survivor Natalie Patillo, together she and cinematographer Daniel Nelson, made the award-winning documentary film And So I Stayed. We interviewed them last year, and today we're sitting down with Natalie again. There is a lot to catch up on. A lot of it is good. Stay with us. What's April's response to this act becoming a law been? Like, how's she doing?
I think this is the first time she's seen the finish line, so to speak. Like, it's given her and others a lot of hope. I'm excited to turn it over to her, like this narrative, like I've been posting online for her on social media. And I'm excited to let her like drive the boat, so to speak,
on her own story.
Hey there, I'm Lucy Kang, reminding you that you're listening to Making Contact. If you or someone you know is experiencing domestic violence, you can call the National Domestic Violence Hotline at 800-799-7233 or text the word BEGIN to 88788. Their website is thehotline.org. Okay, back to the show.
I'm Amy Gastelum. You're listening to Making Contact. We are back in the second half, again talking with reporter Natalie Patillo. So, Natalie, remind me, what year did you start reporting about criminalized survival?
In 2015, Amy. So, oh my God. Yeah. Like,
that's been a while.
It's been a long while.
It's been a long while. And I remember, I mean, because you and I go way back.
Yeah.
Like, full disclosure, you and I go way back. But I do remember that at the time you were really frustrated because there was pretty much no data, no numbers to stand on in terms of how many people were incarcerated for actions resulting from IPV situations. And I know that as a journalist, having data is everything. You cannot report on what isn't proven.
It was really frustrating. It was like, here is this issue that I am hearing through my reporting isn't anecdotal, isn't like, oh, a one-off, isn't something that happens sometimes in one community. And I'm like, well, where's the data? There was nothing for me to look at on a national level of how often this was happening.
Well, guess what, girl? They did it in California.
I know. It was so exciting. I was like, wow.
They did that. They actually went through everything. As you know, Stanford University's Criminal Justice Center launched the Regilla Project a few years ago. And so this group of faculty and students has conducted a research project to better understand exactly this, criminalized survivors of intimate partner violence.
I'm Debbie Muckamal, and I'm the executive director of the Stanford Criminal Justice Center.
She told me that back during COVID lockdowns, they had invited the journalist Rachel Louise Snyder to talk about her book, No Visible Bruises, What We Don't Know About Domestic Violence Can Kill Us. Well, Debbie told me that Rachel had the same exact complaint as you, that there was no data on criminalized survivors. And so that really fired up Debbie and David Sklansky, the faculty co-chair, to take some action. And they were like, we can do that. Like, we can get this data. So here's Debbie.
And very quickly, we brought Andrea in as a gender violence expert.
I am Andrea Cimino. I am the director of research for the Regilla Project.
So, Natalie, Andrea told me that they invited all of the people in California women's prisons who were incarcerated for manslaughter or murder to participate in this study. So they ended up surveying 625 people. And because of the way that housing is done in prison facilities in California, they included cisgender women, trans women, and trans men. And so the Regilla Project, they did not rely on court documents or letters in the mail for this survey. These were face-to-face interviews. So here we go. Here's the big number. They found that a little over 74% of the people surveyed scored positive for intimate partner violence in the year preceding their arrest. 74%. Wow. That's almost 3 out of 4. How's that hitting you?
I'm not completely surprised based off of the reporting that I've done throughout the years, mm-hmm. the stories that I've heard throughout the years. It is heartbreaking. It actually makes me really emotional.
Yeah. Well, and I wanted to include this piece from Debbie that is a bit of a caveat.
You know, we started the study with the question, how many women are incarcerated for killing their abuser? And we thought that that was the approach that we would take, really trying to hone in on where the decedent was the intimate partner. But what we quickly realized in designing the study was that that approach would be too narrow. And we needed to include everybody, no matter who the decedent was.
Here's Andrea.
So women who killed their child, women who killed strangers, even had histories of intimate partner violence and were in potentially lethal relationships.
I just also want to emphasize that we should be careful with the language. Women who are responsible for the killing of someone. Sometimes they were not the people who actually committed the act, but they were legally found responsible for the killing of someone. And it's an important distinction to make, particularly when you get to coerced killings, when you get to aiding and abetting liability, that includes failure to protect children and the like.
Are your findings from California generalizable across the country?
We have no reason to believe that they are not generalizable. In fact, we believe that things could be more stark in other states, given that California does have included in our legal paradigm different accommodations for people who have histories of intimate partner violence in our evidence law, in our parole law. And so we believe that the findings would be the same, if not higher, in other jurisdictions.
Like any study, some of what they learned surprised them. And to be honest, it surprised me too.
So at least 16 people talked about the abuse was so bad, I started to self-medicate with drugs and alcohol. I then got into a driving-related accident and I killed a stranger. So we need to go back. Where does that come from? And how does the intimate partner violence relate to the stranger being killed in a DUI.
You keep pulling that thread and it comes back to the home. And it's in so many homes. Did I read this right? That's some statistic that showed like half of women in the United States will come up against IPV at some point in their life. Is that ringing a bell, Andrea? I know you're going to know.
Yeah. Little less than half. Around half in their lifetime. Yes. And we found 10 times as much in this group of women compared to national statistics.
Natalie, so what else is new? What else is there to report? I know that you have some presentation coming up. Can you tell me about that?
Yeah, there are some exciting screenings coming up. New York State Unified Court System. They're asking me to talk to them about my experiences making And So I Stayed. And they knew I was a survivor, but they didn't know that I had fought to protect my own daughter in that very same system, the New York family court system. Mm. And I can't quite put into words what that feels like, other than this is kind of what I wanted the entire time, was like, can I just get everyone's attention, please? Can I just get the judge's attention? I just want to explain what it's like to be put into our shoes, where we have to put a child to sleep who is scared that they might have to visit an abusive parent. So when that came across my inbox, I still can't believe it. It's like full circle. And that will happen in November.
Thank you for sharing that and just being vulnerable with us. And I have to say, like, as I'm listening to you, that like so many of the people I've talked to for this episode particularly have shared that they have some relationship to domestic violence themselves. And I am really, personally, I feel very like heartened about the kind of coalition building that has happened among survivors to make something happen.
Absolutely.
There's a thread there. There's definitely a thread there. The passion of what it means to reclaim power from systems that would have us not have it. If you want Natalie to come and present her incredible, moving, award-winning film in your community, or your school or your prison, how can people find you, Natalie?
They can find us through our website, which is andsoistayedfilm.com.
Well, I condone rest and, doing softer things like gardening.
Yes, yes. I just picked off an heirloom eggplant that's orange.
What? Orange eggplant? I'm into it. It's very cool.
So that's kind of my life right now. it's like the end of season. So I need to figure out what my winter joy is. Yes. As we all do, I'm pretty sure.
Yeah. I'm Amy Gastelum. You've been listening to Making Contact. If you or someone you know is experiencing domestic violence, you can call the National Domestic Violence Hotline at 800-799-7233 or text the word BEGIN to 88788. Their website is thehotline.org.
You can support KPFK and our show today. Just go to the kpfk.org website and just click the donate button. It's that easy. And that was the kind of story we love to highlight. Not just stories of what's going wrong. We like to bring you stories of activists telling you how they're standing up to injustice, and feminist artists and creatives who are making films and writing books about ways to make change in the world, different ways to see the world. Plus, of course, local activists telling you ways that you can take action and make a difference yourself. So that's what we actually mean when we say at the top of the show every week that we're bringing you a mix of intersectional stories and guests to help you resist, but also engage. And you can support us to keep doing that right now. You just go to kpfk.org, the website, and you click the donate button. And this is Feminist Magazine on KPFK 90.7 FM and kpfk.org. And I'm your host today, Lynn Harris-Ballin. And we're proud to be on KPFK, along with a whole other host of varied voices from the community, but also varied perspectives, perspectives that you're not going to hear anywhere else on the radio dial, not in any of the kind of canned and already digested versions of news that you'll get anywhere else. But right here on KPFK, we're bringing you stories from our activism, from our lives, and from folks that we're excited to share with you. You can support KPFK and our show today. Just go to the kpfk.org website and just click the donate button. It's that easy.
Una obra de teatro brutal.
Todos somos parte de un sistema que pues, nos tiene olvidados.
Donde sus personajes se destrozan. Pero se reconstruyen a partir de su miseria.
Yo pienso que una cosa es la pobreza y otra cosa también es como la miseria del alma o la miseria humana. O...
Ir hasta el piso, ir a lo más bajo, lo más profundo del ser humano, ¿no?
Este miércoles 18 de diciembre, 8:30 de la noche, en Senderos de Oaxaca, la entrevista exclusiva del exitoso grupo de teatro Vaca 35 por KPFK en la radioserie Teatro Profundo, conducida por Ricardo Núñez Román.
You're listening to Feminist Magazine on KPFK on 90.7 FM and kpfk.org. Organizers and activists, we've all been in those meetings, you know, the ones where we need to make decisions as a group or to vision a larger goal. And those kinds of meetings can be a struggle. They can be filled with lots of egos and unspoken agendas. Our guest today is Adrienne Marie Brown. She's an author, a visionary thinker, and so much more. And she has a new book called Holding Change, that offers a profound way to transform that process in meetings and in larger movement building in a time that we really so deeply need to shift the ways we work together and envision our future. Welcome to Feminist Magazine, Adrienne.
Thank you, Lynn. It's good to be here. Thanks for having me.
So many exciting and expansive ideas to talk about here, but tell our listeners a little bit about what is holding change? What can holding change look like?
You know, for years before I was formally a facilitator, I didn't know that there was a language for facilitation, for what it was. It was just something that kept happening. You know, I'd be in a meeting like, we need some synthesis, or we need an agenda, or we need... We feel stuck, like, how can we get through this moment? And my friend, Mia Herndon, who is now part of the Emergent Strategy Collective with me, she was the first person to hire me to facilitate. And over the years, I would find myself using different terminology to try to explain what it was I was doing. And one of the emergent terminologies was holding space. People would say, we're holding space. And that was made a lot of sense to me. It's just like we're really creating and holding a space in which humans can move through the difficult with each other with as much ease as possible. And once emergent strategy came out, what became interesting to me was that it wasn't just that we were holding a space in which anything could happen or in which stagnation was cool. We were really trying to hold a space in which change could happen, meaning that the individuals in the space felt like they could change and that was okay, that there was room for them to change, and that the relationships between the people in the space could change, and then that the group altogether could take seriously the fact that they were trying to change the world. And that's what, you know, people who are doing social justice, people who are doing movement work, it's basically people who are like shamelessly saying there's some things with this world that could change, and we believe in our capacity to shape that. It's also an homage to Octavia E. Butler, who in some way, I think all of my work, I always try to touch back to the stone of wisdom that she offered us with so many of her texts, but particularly in the parables, she talks about change and shaping change, being a shaper as opposed to a victim of change. And I feel like that's the call, especially right now when circumstances are so overwhelming, both externally and within movement. It's such an overwhelming thing to try to be like with each other and hold each other. But Octavia said, all that you touch, you change, and all that you change, changes you. And for facilitators and mediators, what we're doing is holding that, holding the changes that happen inevitably when we are in contact with each other, which we have to be on this tiny planet. So that's all the stuff that's happening in that title and in the book.
So much happening in the title. And a sentence that really resonated for me is, the impossibility of consensus calls us to find ways of working together in difference.
Yeah, I think there's, you know, when I first started working in movement, I naively believed that, oh, if we just all had the same information to work from, we would all reach the same conclusions, and then we would flow forward together in a heavenly, you know, Garden of Eden-like existence. And, you know, and so I became obsessed with data initially, you know, like, let's get all the information. Let's make sure we have all the information. And then, of course, you know, what happens with humans, which is we have all the same information. We reach different conclusions because we come from different walks, different socializations, different perspectives, different needs. Many of our needs are unmet, you know, and unnamed. And so we're coming into any space. The difference is actually the point. And I didn't really understand that until I started really studying the natural world more and studying the patterns of emergence and really starting to understand that in a healthy ecosystem, the biodiversity is the health, right? The number of different ways of being that can coexist is a sign of the health. And so then I started thinking, well, what if we facilitated that way? What if we facilitated where the invitation was to have as many different ways of being in the room as possible, but to find ways to align ourselves in emotion towards futures that could sustain all those differences rather than futures that could only sustain one way of being? And that has become and continues to be of deep interest to me, that because I keep changing also, like I keep changing as an individual. So it's not even, it's just like each person is the same unto themselves throughout their lives. Right? It's like we are coming into being and we're changing constantly. We're changing each other. And so how can we don't want to achieve a consensus that requires everyone being the same way and thinking the same things. And Loretta Ross has a beautiful quote about this, which is, a group of people moving the same direction and thinking the same thing is a cult. A group of people thinking different things but moving in the same direction is a movement. And that, you know, I feel like it's such a teaching. It's like, how do we be a biodiverse movement that allows for the many different ways of being, right, to exist? I think disability justice is a great teacher of this also, right? It's like, how do we resist the idea that there's some norm that we're all supposed to achieve and some singular way of thinking that is correct? And instead, how do we embrace the fact that we're complex and we're changing?
Right. And I mean, you've partly started to answer this, but the title of the book is actually Holding Change, the Way of Emergent Strategy, Facilitation and Mediation.
Yes.
So it's part of a series based on your thinking around this idea of emergent strategy, which was your 2017 book. And it's about how we can partner with change,
yes.
Right?
Yes.
So it's a very multi-layered concept, but can you tell our listeners a little bit more about that? It's so fundamental.
Yes. Yeah, so, you know, looking at the natural world, there's certain elements and there's certain principles that, if you pay attention, seem to be present throughout all of the functional systems. So adaptation, intentional adaptation, being able to adapt in ways that move us towards life. Life continuously moves towards life. Fractals, like there's some patterns that move from the smallest scale to the largest scale. Interdependence, right? That in nature, everything is in relationships with each other. Nothing is trying to be an individual pulling itself up by its bootstraps in spite of everyone else, you know? And so the species that are surviving have these patterns. And emergent strategy was starting to ask the question, what would it look like if humans humbled ourselves to find our patterns and to be in pattern with everything else? And, you know, the question, I don't know if you've ever sat and watched a murmuration of birds move through the sky, but they're avoiding predation and there's some guidelines to how they do it. And I started thinking, like, what would it look like if our movement was like a flock of birds? What would it look like if our movement was a murmuration? If we could trust each other, if we had the right space from each other, if we understood ourselves to be a body in motion rather than a bunch of bodies at odds with each other. Mm-hmm. So emergent strategy was that first offering. And then I've been gathering different texts and ideas and thoughts that went with it. But something people kept asking me about was like, well, how do you do facilitation? Because I get a lot of positive feedback about my facilitation. People are like, oh, you're so great at this. And I'm like, some of it is nature, which I put that in holding change. There is a nature. There's some people who I think have a nature that orients around and makes it easy to do facilitation. Like it's in us. We pay attention in a certain way. But some of it can be learned. And I think everyone should have at least a basic concept of it, a basic capacity for it, because we need it in our families, we need it in our communities, right. We need it in our workplace. Even if we're not explicitly doing organizing, we need to be able to be in right relationship with each other. So holding change is my offer towards that. And there's a little bow to the Taoist text, which is the Tao Te Ching, because, you know, they talk about the way that can be named is not the way. Like, immediately, as soon as you try to say it, you know, like trying to put in a book, like, here's how I do what I do. I knew that there were some things that would never be translatable or couldn't go on the page. I'm still doing my best to offer the way of emergent strategy facilitation and mediation. And to that end, I have a lot of contributors in the book, a whole series of other Black feminists who are alive and working right now who have different ways than I do. And I thought that that was a way of nodding to that, right? That it's like, it's not actually one way. The way is a complex offering of ways of adapting together, breathing together, listening to each other, leaning into each other, grieving together, growing together.
Right. And let's talk about that. You've got this deeply significant section of writings under the heading Black Feminist Wisdom.
Yes.
And it includes some of my personal favorite movement writers,
mine
thinkers,
too.
Organizers. Yeah. I mean, particularly like Alexis Pauline Gums and Melchior Cyril. And you talk about being part of a lineage, right, as a facilitator. What does that lineage mean? And how do these particular writers that you invited in, how do they hold that lineage with you?
Yeah. Well, you know, for me, I think there's a moment when you recognize nothing we're doing is being done for the first time. You know, Octavia talks about, like, there's nothing new under the sun, but there are new suns. And I love that idea of, like, how do we, in our work, honor the fact that, like, there's nothing new. We learned this from ancestors. You know, when we look back at the people that we honor as organizers, really a lot of what they were doing was also facilitation, right? They were gathering, they were synthesizing, they were helping people figure out what moves could happen. That's a core piece of what it means to be moving other humans along in any shape. So some of them that are quoted in the book are Ella Baker, Fannie Lou Hamer, Harriet Tubman. These are people who I think of as a lineage of Black women, Black feminists who pointed the way, helped gather, helped listen, helped to decenter, right? They were like, it's not about me. You have to make a choice to opt into history. You have to make a choice to opt into your potential and your greatness. So for me, the lineage is there. And then I think if you look at most of those people in the book, all of them are people who I've seen name explicitly. Oh, I'm in the lineage of Audre Lorde. Adaku Utah, who offers us the Care Bear, the Care Bear approach of these care teams that allow a room to care for itself and create a community culture of care. She says that she partnered with Harriet Tubman in her work to create Harriet's Apothecary and create a healing arm inside of movement, right? Mm-hmm. A lot of the people in the book, Alexis, is one of the first people who really gave me direct access to a lot of the lineage by saying, we need to take these words of Audre Lorde, I am who I am, doing what I came to do, and we need to chant them, and we need to let them be embodied in us. Harriet Tubman said, my people are free, not will be free, but are free. You know, mm-hmm. how do I embody that? So I think these people, one of the things that I wanted to do was shine a light on them while they're alive, right? Oh, yeah. And say, like, you are a part of Black movements, and you're part of multiracial movements, and you're part of movements for change, in large part because of these people. These people are behind the scenes, holding space, holding change, holding connections, mediating conversations, helping people create safer spaces, helping people think about security, helping people think about boundaries. Like, these are these Black women who are behind the scenes doing this work. And often they don't get seen until they've passed. And, you know, people are like, okay, now let's give them their flowers. But I'm like, they're alive. You can access their wisdom right now. You know,
yeah.
They are going to continue to learn and change and write, and you should be paying attention to them. So that's what felt important to me. And to be able to say, to have also expressions where it was like, it wasn't just Black feminists who were femme presenting or femme identifying, but it was a wide spectrum of Black feminists who I included in the text, because that also feels important to understand in the current moment. But I think that they are the lineage for any future generations of movement, right? We are the lineage, and I wanted to name ourselves and weave ourselves in explicitly. Like, here's what we are thinking about. Here's something that we have to offer. Here's some things that we know.
We're talking to Adrienne Marie Brown about her new book, Holding Change. So lineage in the sense of, it's not a past thing that you sort of look at and polish and put on a shelf, but it's current and living and woven in. Yeah.
Yeah, I feel like one of the things that indigenous mm-hmm. worldview holds is that seven generations back, seven generations ahead,
right.
That you're actually always in the river that has directions of flow in both ways. And something about that to me is like, well, then how do I be a responsible future ancestor, as well as how do I responsibly receive what has been offered to me?
And so they're talking about things like breathing and boundaries and, you know, space, safe space or not safe space. There's actually mm-hmm. both. And also the ways of facilitation that you offer are all deeply part of feminist thought. And yet so much we hear sort of the 101, like the equal rights and the, but I love that you bring in all of this kind of deeper and more horizontal, collaborative, those aspects of feminism that sometimes we forget, right?
Absolutely. I mean, I think that we can get so caught up in contending for what's the definition, what's the way that it's done, and we really can focus on the mistakes that have been made, you know, which every movement is constantly making mistakes. And I think there's, you know, my thing is, I don't think there's failure. I think there's data. And I think we can harness that data. I think we can say, oh, what did first wave feminism push and open and do? And what was the data? What did we learn? What mm-hmm. did second wave feminism do? What did we learn? Where does intersectionality open new pathways for us? And what did we learn? Right. And to me, if you hold it that way, what we're learning all along is there are different ways for us to be leaders. There are different ways for us to be in community. And if you have a balance where all the different parts of a society are held equally in shaping those ways, all of a sudden new possibilities come into being.
Well, thank you so much, Adrienne Marie Brown, for joining us to talk about your book, Holding Change.
To your river.
Support KPFK and our show today, Feminist Magazine. Just go to the kpfk.org website and click that donate button or call 818-985-5735 or 818-985-KPFK. So during this fund drive, and we're limiting the number of interruptions and preemptions so that your favorite programs like this one can keep going on the air, providing you with the information and the news that you can only get on KPFK. So please show your support for the station and for this approach. We want you to kind of vote with your actions and say, yeah, we want to keep having programming. But the way we'll know that is if you support us. We want to keep doing this approach to fundraising, but you can do your part by pledging online, kpfk.org, or call 818-985-5735. If it's been a while since you last donated, even if you've never donated before, if you've been listening but you've never donated before, there's no time like the present. Don't procrastinate. We want to go forward. So do it now and make a generous donation, as generous as you can, to keep KPFK part of your daily life, to keep Feminist Magazine part of your weekly life. We're in challenging times, and your contribution really is vitally important. So we thank you for your help and support. We thank you on behalf of all of the other listeners and all of us right here at KPFK. We work as a collective of diverse voices and contributors. And like you heard in that last segment, that whole thing of diverse voices is not just a set of differences, but a way to kind of come together, collaborate, and make something bigger and better. And that's what we do on our show, Feminist Magazine, and that's what KPFK does as well. So it means that there's a bunch of viewpoints giving you, our listeners, all kinds of perspectives, stories, and guests every week. And it goes across generations too. We mentor new contributors here on Feminist Magazine. We love doing that. We love teaching radio skills like interviewing, engineering, and editing to young college students, to grassroots feminists from different communities across the city. And all of us who are part of the show are activists in different communities around LA, but we give our time and sweat to FemMag because we believe in radio. Go to kpfk.org and click donate if you want this to keep happening and these kinds of stories, this kind of work, to be there every week for you. We're inviting you to give $100 or be a sustainer, and that is amazing to keep KPFK sustainable. You give us your credit card, you say how much you want to donate every month, and then it's automatically taken out. You don't have to worry about it. We have a sustainable base that we can work from, that we can build from. We have all kept going for you, so show us a little love, won't you? Go to kpfk.org and click that donate button right now to support the show. And speaking of love, we love getting feedback from listeners about the show. We've been getting great feedback on our programming during this fund drive. It's part of an ongoing wave of being part of making change, and we're happy to support that. Thanks to all our guests and contributors today. And now is your last chance to support KPFK in this hour, in the Feminist Magazine hour. So if you like what you just heard on Feminist Magazine, please support us to keep doing that. Go to kpfk.org and click the donate button or call 818-985-5735. And thank you.
Due to years of deferred maintenance at KPFK's transmitter site, it has become imperative to repair critical components to continue broadcasting at full power. Now we have an exciting opportunity to ensure the full power signal of KPFK, allowing us to continue to reach all our listeners, improve our broadcast quality, and connect with all the communities that need our message. However, we can't do it without you. Please support the Transmitter Repair Fund in our December fund drive by calling 818-985-5735, press option 2, or pledge online anytime at kpfk.org and click the red transmitter on the front page of the website. Any additional funds raised for this project will support our daily operations, including resuming regular maintenance at the transmitter site. Thanks for donating to People Powered KPFK, and happy holidays to all.